Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Manuel Centre for this, what is going to try to be a live version of our Coffee House Shots podcast. Well, this is going to be, an incredibly unpredictable election. If any of you are feeling confident about the result, you're making a big mistake. But here to explain it, please welcome my colleagues, James Forsyth, Katie Bowles, and the University of Kent's Professor Matthew Goodwin. Now, before we start, some of you might know that I'm a great lover of data and charts, and I've got just a few I wanted to share with you tonight to show how things are going. So this is the great Christmas election. We're all, you know, Christmas is chaotic enough without these guys at our doors. I've been getting leaflets. It's funny, the Tory candidate, her name's Isabel, but doesn't actually admit she's a Conservative. The word Conservative is nowhere in her literature. So it's pretty strange. You don't even know who's representing what party in this election. And this is what the opinion polls look like. And you can see this very kind of unusual moment where they almost all got together. And then whoosh, when Boris became leader of the party, the Brexit party plunges, the Tories soared. And that is the latest poll from YouGov says the Brexit party is now down to 4%, which is logical given that they're now not standing in half of the seats. But if this makes you feel confident about a Conservative victory, then bear in mind how the polls looked like in the 2017 campaign. Now look at that huge Tory lead there, all the way through. And do you remember how cocksure the Tories were that they were going to absolutely crush the Labour Party? So sure, but nobody really noticed this steady rise in the Labour vote, which turned out to rob Theresa May of her majority. Now, we've done this, so that's 5 weeks before the poll, 10 weeks before the poll. So let's see how the opinion polls look this time around. The Tories, you know, are doing all right, but are nowhere near as popular as they were under Theresa May. There's still quite a big gap there. And the Labour Party, it's on track. So if this trajectory is followed, then put it this way, there's nothing to be certain about on election day. Now, these guys might be coming to a government near you pretty soon, Labour's Incredibles. I'm guessing, I'm not going to do a show of hands for who's going to vote Labour tonight, but if any of you are tempted to think these guys are just too crazy to be elected, look at their nationalist policies, look at the nationalising policies, who would vote for that? Look at these various policies here. This is one, by the way, if those of you don't follow Matt Goodwin on Twitter, you should. His Twitter feed is a source of much inspiration. And this was something he tweeted the other day. So various Labour policies, nationalised gas and electricity, water, wealth tax, workers on boards, nationalised railways, do you think the rich don't pay their fair share of tax? This is Corbynomics, and let's see how much national support there is for each of these Corbynite propositions. 45%, 50% want to nationalise water, 53% support a wealth tax, 55% workers on boards, 56% most of the country want to nationalise the railways, most think the rich don't pay their fair share of tax, and the 50% tax rate. Suffice to say that if you catch yourself thinking that Corbyn's proposals are radical or fringe or extreme, then stop that thought and remember that most people in the country, it strikes them as common sense. So if you think the radicalism of Corbyn is somehow a law which means he's not going to be elected, that there's some law of gravity, forget it. What he's saying strikes most people as common sense. Now, by the way, look at the Tories. This is the spending as a share of GDP. You can see right now the Tories will take it up to the highest level since the 1970s if you discount the period at the top, which was post-crash, and the Labour want to take it up as well. But both parties are promising a fairly serious spending splurge. The Tories will struggle really to present themselves as the party of fiscal responsibility. And given that we didn't have a budget this time around, I pulled out some other charts. You'll have seen that the growth forecasts, downgrades we've had in the UK, have been significant, but not as bad as Germany, not as bad is France. And also look at our growth, pretty much middle of the pack. There is no great sort of Brexit-induced debacle on the economy right now. Certainly, most other countries in Europe, in fact, in the G7, have got their own variations of similar problems, and that's next year's growth as well. The jobs, today we found unemployment is down to a record low, and look at these are all the forecasts for employment. Every year, the economy overshoots these forecasts. This economy we're living in is a huge jobs-creating machine. Now you might say, lots of jobs, but why are there so many jobs? Because look at the earnings. The average pay rise, the average salary is still quite far behind where it was in the crash. It's not due to get back there for something like 20 years after the crash. Now, this is not an encouraging trend, but bear something in mind. This is the average salary. Now, what do you think is happening to the salaries of the people at the bottom versus the salaries of the people at the top? The Corbynite narrative is quite simple, that what growth there has been has gone to the richest. But have a look at these are figures I pulled up myself. They haven't been published yet. If you actually look at the percentage increase of the people at the bottom 10% and the top 10%, the guys at the bottom are doing the best out of this decade. These are conservative policies that involve minimum wages and other things. Now, they've made sure that the poorest have seen the highest wage increases and the richest have seen the sharpest wage decreases over the course of this decade. It's true that there has been misery for a lot of people on average, but the poorer you are, the more likely you are to have seen your pay rise over the last 10 years. And that's because the government is now setting the wages through the minimum wage of 1 in 6 employees in this country with an intention of doing it to 1 in 4. Now that is quite audacious. Quite often, Philip Hammond, when he sort of flounced out of the Tories, said that this was a far-right party. These policies are, put it this way, you couldn't quite describe them as Thatcherite. This is a heavy-spending, quite high-regulating Conservative Party which is going for Labour leave seats and adopting policies which would have been written off 10 years ago as way too left-wing even for the Labour Party. Now, meanwhile, you've got the battle in Scotland, something I think is worth keeping an eye on, because this was the scene weekend before last in George Square in Glasgow. Effectively, it is a referendum campaign starting off again. And it's this is the Yes campaign is going, because you can see that the support is actually now narrowing. The polls were quite, after the Brexit vote, the Scottish separatists were still quite low in their support. There was quite a big gap. That has now narrowed. This is their chance. So in Scotland, there is effectively another referendum campaign that will help the Conservatives. And if they were to go independent, the Scots, have a look at this. That's the UK's deficit amongst the rest of the developed world, OECD. If Scotland was independent, its deficit would look like that. Now, you know, would you even get into the EU with a deficit like that? It would be massive tax, you'd have to be massive tax increases or massive spending cuts if Scotland were to be an independent country. And if you think that means they wouldn't vote for it, just remember the warnings given before the Brexit vote, that the world would fall apart, be like £4,300 worse off. People still voted for it. People tend not to get put off that much by charts like these nowadays. And finally, this is what the Betfair, right? Thinks is going to happen. 56% chance of a Conservative majority, 41% chance of a hung parliament, a 3% chance of a Labour majority. But remember that the SNP plus Labour equals government. So hung parliament could very well deliver us a Corbyn government. And if it does happen, then don't say we didn't warn you tonight.
So polling day is exactly a month away. And tomorrow it'll be the first week done of the election campaign. And I think this first week of the formal campaign has seen the chance of a Tory majority increase quite significantly. That's not because anything in particular the Tories have done, but some developments in the wider battlefield. The most important of these is the Brexit Party's decision to stand down in Tory-held seats. This not only makes it easier for the Tories to hold on to the seats that they already have, but it also gives the Tories a squeeze message on those people planning to vote for the Brexit Party in those all-important Labour marginals particularly in the Midlands, that are going to determine the result of this election. Because Nigel Farage has effectively conceded that the Tory attack line is true. Vote Brexit Party, and you might not get Brexit, and you might get a Corbyn government. That's why he's standing down in those Tory-held seats. And I mean, that makes it that much easier for the Tories to squeeze that Brexit Party vote right down in the seats that decide the election. What the Tories are trying to do in the Midlands is essentially what they did to the Liberal Democrats in the South West in the 2015 election. They turned up in the region and basically said, if you don't want a Labour government with the SNP holding the balance of power, you have to vote Tory. Voting Lib Dem doesn't do you any good, and it risks that outcome. And the Tories relentlessly drove that message home. And because they were going for a concentrated number of Lib Dem seats, both the national media and the local media were kind of self-reinforcing messages. And I think the Tories are trying to do the same thing in the Midlands this time round, with people planning to vote for the Brexit Party. And I think Farage's announcement this week makes it that much easier. The YouGov poll that Fraser referred to earlier out today, this is the first poll conducted since Farage made this announcement. And it's also very important because it's the poll that most closely reflects the general election, because it shows people the ballot paper. So it names their local MP. So what it gives you an idea about is how much the incumbency effect is, what effect incumbency is having. And one of the things that you in 2017 defeated the Tories was that while the national polls were great, when you asked people what they were going to vote for when it came to their own MP, they were more sympathetic to their local Labour MP because they didn't see him as being the same as Jeremy Corbyn necessarily. That YouGov poll out today has the Tories over 40% for the first time since the Brexit Party was formed, and it has them 14 points ahead. If the Tories are 14 points ahead of Labour and over 40%, they are going to get a majority. And I mean, we are discussing the size of it. So I think that is the first thing which has made a Tory majority more likely. I think the second thing is Nicola Sturgeon has been almost as helpful to the Tories as Nigel Farage. Because up in Scotland, to an extent that I think we are not appreciating in London, she is driving home the message every day that in a hung parliament, the SNP will demand the right to hold a second independence referendum. That is driving unionist tactical voting in Scotland to keep the SNP out, and it is allowing the Scottish Tories to further squeeze the Scottish Labour vote. Back in September, the Scottish Tories thought they were going to lose 10 of their 13 seats. They now think they're going to hold 8 of those 13 seats, and they are optimistic that that number might fall further. And I think one of the other things that is positive for the Tories is, the Tories had a very, if we were doing this recording a week ago, the Tories had a very rocky week. You had Jacob Rees-Mogg's comments, you had Alan Cairns having to resign. And I mean, that made people think, oh my word, it's happening all over again, the Tories are going to blow it again. But those were kind of individual acts of idiocy rather than strategic flaws in the campaign. And I think what we're seeing now is that the Tory messaging in this election is very effective. When you watch Vox Pops back on the 6 o'clock news or 10 o'clock news, it's remarkable how often voters are repeating back the Tories' messages. And I think one of the reasons that is happening is because the Tories' messaging is all coming out of focus groups. They are essentially repeating back to voters what the voters are saying to them. So, get Brexit done wasn't a message that the Tories came up with and then focus grouped. It was a message that came out of focus groups. Voters kept saying, we just need to get Brexit done. Get Brexit done. The two referendums message, again, came out of focus groups. And so they are finding it easier to get through to voters because they are saying to them what voters already think. And that is why I think the chance of the majority have increased. And the other thing I think is this is, I think if generals are always guilty of fighting the last war, we journalists are always guilty of covering the last campaign. And in 2015, we spent the entire campaign thinking about a hung parliament because none of us had seen that hung parliament coming in 2010. So every night we waited for the seat projection models to come out and we worked out, you know, would Sylvia Herman in North Down support a Tory government or a Labour government? And we spent the entire time obsessing about what would happen in a hung parliament. 2015 delivered an unexpected Tory majority. So in 2017, we barely talked about a hung parliament. We thought, oh, it's not going to happen. And this time round, we keep thinking that 2017 is going to happen again, that Labour vote share is inevitably going to rise. I'm not sure that that analysis is right. Soufflés don't rise twice. And I think Jeremy Corbyn's ratings, you know, it's one thing to go from people not having much of an opinion on you to people thinking, oh, he's talking some sense. It's quite another thing for people to turn their backs on you and then turn back to you. And I do wonder sometimes whether we're all slightly getting this election wrong because we're all imagining that it is going to be 2017 all over again, when there's no mechanical reason why Labour should go up by 8 or 9 points during the campaign. So for all of those reasons, while there is still a month to go, and there's a very long way to that, there is a lot, many slip twixt cup and lip. But I think a Tory majority looks more likely today, far more likely today than it did when Parliament voted for an election on October 29th. And that date is one of the other, my final point, which is there was a big question of what would happen if Brexit was not delivered on October 31st. Some polls taken in October suggested that the Brexit Party would jump up to 20%. The Tories would fall back into the mid-20s. We are now 2 weeks on from October 31st, and the polls suggest that Leave voters really aren't blaming Boris Johnson for that at all, and they think that it's Parliament's fault, and that also is justifying his rationale for having an election. One of Theresa May's big problems in 2017 was, apart from her own self-interest, she could not explain why people were being forced to go to the polling station again, having gone to the polling station a year before in a referendum and the year before that in a general election. I think voters, having seen how Parliament has behaved over the last 2.5 years, are far more sympathetic to the case for a general election now than they were in 2017.
I'm going to be what Boris Johnson and perhaps James, judging from that, might call a gloomster, and talk about some of the potential reasons to have a bit of urge caution when we're talking about how the Tories might fare, because it's definitely the case that there is a sustainable and a continued poll lead for the Tories. As Fraser showed in his graphs, we have seen that before. And ultimately, what makes us so risky for the Conservative Party in terms of this election is they're looking to pick up seats that have never voted Tory before. So this isn't a tried and tested route. If anything, the route was tried in 2017 and it didn't quite go to plan. So it's almost the Theresa May strategy 2.0, trying to aim for these Labour Tory marginals, Labour heartlands that voted heavily to leave, and see if you can get them to put tribal allegiance aside and vote for the Tory party. Now, the hope of those around Boris Johnson is that a slicker campaign, a better communicator, and less gaffes and probably more television debates is going to help the Tories actually get over the line this time. And when you're talking about the areas that the Tories are looking to pick up seats, I think it's probably helpful to talk about where they might lose seats. Now, there has been this sense that they will lose seats in certain Lib Dem Tory marginals in the southwest, and that's definitely an area the Tories are still worried about. There's also Scotland, where it's definitely the case, as James touched on, that Scottish Conservative MPs feel more hopeful. I still don't think it's a sense that they're going to make gains there. There was one blog in Scotland by a Scottish Labour blogger saying they could actually make gains. But there's a sense you will lose seats there, you will lose seats to the Lib Dems. And in terms of London, that could be quite tricky if you look at certain seats. So where are you going to make up these seats? Now, what is being described by pollsters as a red wall is this swathe of seats if you look in the Midlands and the North and also onto Wales, which voted heavily to leave but are tribally Labour. Now, the Tories are focusing there. There's lots of very small majorities. And ultimately, the Brexit Party is also aiming at these seats. So when we saw Nigel Farage talking earlier this week about standing down in Tory-held seats, there was some, I think, relief in CCHQ. But ultimately, the general sense was, you're not standing down in the seats we actually need to win to get a majority. So it didn't really go all the way. And I think that if, as a YouGov poll tonight suggests, the Brexit Party support is squashed significantly, it might not be such an issue that the Brexit Party is still standing seats in lots of target seats like Ashfield. But ultimately, if you look at places like Dudley, the majorities are so slim there. The Labour majority is 22 votes. So if you have a Brexit Party candidate, they don't have to get many potential Tory votes. Before you know it, it starts to get trickier. So I think that's one thing to think about, how they are going to get those seats. And speaking to Conservative MPs at the weekend, I'm really struck by everyone thinks the polls are good, but if you call around Conservative MPs in Wales, they're very sceptical of this idea you often hear in Westminster from Tory strategists, probably Tory strategists who haven't spent that much time in Wales, who say that you can pick up a lot of seats here because demographically, these are exactly the type of voters who will switch to the Tory party. Now, those on the doorstep think that perhaps you can make two or three gains, on a good day, six in Wales, but they don't see this big switch that you're seeing in some of these calculations that you hear figures closer to number 10 talk about. Also in the North East, if you speak to Conservative MPs there, again, you get the sense of saying, I do think we'll pick up seats, but if it's my area we're talking about, I'm not so sure. And you start to call around the electoral map which the Tories are going for, and you get a sense of, where are these seats coming from? Now, it might be that the margins are so slight, and I do think, ultimately, as James touched on, so many Conservative MPs are scarred by 2017. They are scared to sound at all optimistic, because to do that might be to sound complacent, and you get back to this sense that they presume a majority is happening. But I think just the different type of demographic vote they are going for makes it harder. All the Tory candidates have been given a handbook in which they've been told, you know, who to look out for in terms of voters they can persuade to come on over. And it's Labour Leave voters, it's soft Labour voters, it's traditional Tory voters who voted Remain that they need to work to try and convince to come back, and also non-voters. So there's a big focus on, if you look at the EU referendum shock result when Leave won, that was put down in some areas to more non-voters, people who aren't traditionally, people who vote particularly, coming out and actually voting for Leave. And the Tories want to try and tap into that and get these voters out. Now, in terms of the Labour support, at the moment, there is a clear gap between Labour and the Tories, and you're not seeing this Corbyn mania, which you could call, which we had an outbreak at the last election. However, I think there is reason to pay a particular notice to the first head-to-head debate, which will be next week on ITV. Now, the Tories think that they have, I think, done quite well in getting this to be a one-on-one debate just with Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson. And that's because on the question of who would make the best Prime Minister, Boris Johnson clearly leads and his popularity has been increasing. Jo Swinson is none too happy about this, and the Liberal Democrats have taken it to the point that they're actually taking legal action for not being included in this, because they say there has to be a true voice of Remain for voters to look at, and Labour doesn't offer this. I think there was a risk to Boris Johnson in this two-person debate. Ultimately, the entire Tory strategy rests on uniting the Leave vote and then the Remain vote being divided. Now, to have a one-on-one debate with Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, where Jo Swinson isn't even in the picture, does give Jeremy Corbyn a good opportunity, should he wish to take it, to pitch himself as the only real voice of Remain if he wants to move, and to say, if you want a second referendum, a Labour government is the only way forward. Now, that does rely on him putting in a good performance and going for that tactic, but you can start to see how these platforms, because we have more head-to-head debates coming up, might allow Labour the space to squeeze the Liberal Democrats. And as soon as the Liberal Democrats are squeezed significantly, those graphs we were looking at start to look quite different if the Liberal Democrat vote goes to Labour and you start to get a much closer, more neck and neck, two-party electoral race, Labour and the Tories. And I think that would change the political landscape significantly. So that's the thought I'm going to leave you on at whether or not it's welcomed.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming along. I was delighted to be invited. I'm a big fan of The Spectator, and then Fraser said I could bring slides. So as an academic, I was double excited. And I wanted to start with this one, which is, what has happened to the world's most stable two-party system? I gave a talk in Milan recently to Italians who are laughing at British politics, which says something when the Italians, who have had 49 governments in 50 years, are laughing at the state of our party system. But you can see, really, as Fraser pointed out, what's happened since March 2019, and you can see how that two-party system has imploded into a four-party race. And this is some of the latest polling, so you can see how the Brexit Party is being gradually squeezed down. As the previous speaker said, the Lib Dems too are now being squeezed, and this is quickly becoming a two-party race. And I think what's really interesting, firstly, is that if we step back from this immediate campaign and election, what's clear to me at least is that we are living through a profound realignment of British politics. Peter Pulitzer in 1967 once said that the basis of British politics is social class. All else is embellishment and detail. Well, actually, that unwritten rule is being overturned. The new dividing line in British politics is age. In case you're interested, 47 is the age at which you flip over statistically from being more likely to vote Conservative than Labour. As my friend at Oxford, James Tilley, has shown, every one of us will become 0.96% more conservative as every year of our life passes. I do remind my first-year students about that fact. Here's one thing to bear in mind. My first-year students were born in 2001. They have absolutely no memory of 9/11. They don't remember Tony Blair and New Labour. They don't remember the financial crisis. All I've known is austerity, said one. Margaret Thatcher is ancient history. The first election they really remember is 2010. They think the Liberal Democrats being in power is completely normal. They've been treated to no less than 9 electoral contests in a decade. A generation that has been raised on binge-watching Netflix has binge-watched politics. And this is a generation, by the way, that was not eligible to vote in 2016, was not eligible to vote at the 2017 election, and is now going to turn out for the first time. They haven't been active participants in our culture war, but they've been observers. Let me give you one set of statistics that I think you'll find particularly interesting. If you look at how 18 to 24-year-olds in Britain are going to vote, at the end of October, 35% were voting Labour. November the 1st, 44% were voting Labour. November the 6th, a couple of days ago, 54% are voting Labour. So that youth vote, which we saw mobilise in 2017, is beginning to pay attention to this campaign, which is another reason why I would expect further volatility. Is it the start of something significant? Perhaps. There's no way in this world that I think the Green Party are going to be polling 3 to 5% in December. I think the Greens will be squeezed. And from everything that I'm hearing from my friends in the Liberal Democrat camp, they are expecting to be squeezed as well. And all of that will go to help the Labour Party. And one of the things that I just want to pick up on that Katie mentioned, let's just remember what's happening in those Labour Leave seats. I've done a lot of work on those Labour Leave seats, sitting in a lot of focus groups with voters. Those voters are what we would call in political science cross-pressured. On cultural issues, they agree with the Conservatives. They agree on Brexit, and they agree that we need to reform migration. But on economic issues, they agree with Corbyn. They think the deck is stacked against them. They think the economy is rigged. And what is going to happen in Ashfield, Bishop Auckland, Dudley North, Stoke North, and all of those kinds of seats is an epic battle between whether this is a new culture war between Remain and Leave, Liberals and Conservatives, or whether actually that traditional left-right divide Questions over economic redistribution are going to come back with a vengeance. And remember, Theresa May, how many pro-Brexit Labour seats did she win? She won six. Just six. And her problem is that the average increase in Conservative support in Labour Leave seats, Conservative support went up by 11 points. But Corbyn's vote went up by five. And that pushed many of those Labour seats just outside the grasp of the Conservatives. So whatever Boris Johnson does between now and the election, my advice would be say something about the economy. You've got them on Brexit, you've got them on crime, you've got them on migration. Start talking to them about how you're going to fix regional inequality, how you're going to level the playing field, and how you're going to ensure that other parts of forgotten England feel as included in our national conversation as London does. That's the primary challenge. This is what's been happening, by the way, to those Brexit Party voters. Now, if we go back to, here we go, the European elections, you've got nearly 45% of 2017 Conservatives saying they're going to vote for Farage and the Conservative Party. And then in comes Boris in July, and you can see ever since then, the percentage of Conservative 2017 voters going to the Brexit Party has been crashing and crashing and crashing. The Conservatives need to keep that squeeze on. And the Brexit Party pulling out of those Conservative-held seats will make a difference. I've got a friend at the University of Texas, Professor Howard Clark, who just for tonight, exclusive to you, has run the numbers on if you apply uniform swing model based on the Brexit Party not standing in Conservative-held seats, these are the numbers that you're looking at, assuming the polls do not change from today. Conservatives, 360 seats. Labour, 206. Lib Dem, 21. Greens, 1. SNP, 41. Plaid, 3. Good Conservative majority. But of course, a lot can change, as Katie and James mentioned. It's worth also remembering that we're now exactly a month out from the election. And if you take the average, Conservatives are on 40, Labour is on 28. If you take the average a month out from the 2017 election, Labour's on 28, Conservatives are on 47. We are not too far away from where we were a month out from the 2017 election. And we need to remember that and just set ourselves up for the fact that we might yet see considerable volatility. Just lastly, let's run some forecasts of what could happen. Now, Yanis Varoufakis last night, I was in a debate with him, and he reminded me of a saying that economic forecasts are a bit like sausages. Once you've seen how they're made, you don't want to go near them. So let me expose you to some political forecasts. If you take the current poll trend that we've got, based on the latest opinion polls, you are looking at Conservatives 355, Labour 209, SNP 42, Lib Dems 22. So a good Conservative majority. If you then assume in the middle that the Conservatives win over half of what remains of the Brexit Party vote, then you begin to enter much more comfortable waters for the Conservative Party. Conservative Party seats go up to about 380. Labour fall below 200. They start to go back to where they were in 1918, 1922, that sort of territory. But here's the interesting one. What if Katie's right? What if the Labour Party really does start to rally during the general election, during the election campaign? What if the Greens are squeezed, the Lib Dems are squeezed? So what we've done here is we've taken the difference between where we are now and the 2017 result for Labour, and we've assumed that half of that is going to hit the Conservative Party. And the Conservatives are reduced to 307, Labour's on 261, SNP's on 45. We're back very much in hung parliament territory. So there's all to play for. And one of the things that makes it incredibly difficult for me as a political scientist is just the rate of volatility that we're seeing in British politics. Now, my friends in economics are constantly reminded that they failed to see the crisis coming. Political scientists, to be frank, failed to see political shocks coming. They failed to see the Brexit shock. They failed to see the Trump shock. They failed to see the disintegration of Europe's party system. And one of the reasons as to why that happened is simply because of the sheer number of people who are switching their vote from one party to another. And if you look at British politics between 2010 and 2017, the British election study tells us that no less than 49% of all voters change their vote from one party to another. Conservative Remainers going Lib Dems, Labour Leavers going Conservative, UKIP going Conservative, then going Brexit Party, SNP going Lib Dem, some Labour going to the SNP. Constant flux, constant change. And that means as we go into the final few weeks of this campaign, we need to remember that I think volatility is going to be a big marker of what happens. It may be that in the early weeks of December, we see the Conservative Party continuing its realignment in British politics. You know, one of the inevitable byproducts of the vote for Brexit perhaps was the realignment of the Conservative Party. It's becoming a little bit more working class, a little bit more blue collar, a little bit more pro-Brexit, a little bit more socially conservative, while Labour is doubling down on many of the university towns, the big cities. And all of this is pushing us further and further into this bigger realignment. So I think it's going to be a fascinating campaign. It's going to be the most consequential elections, the most consequential election in post-war history. I think more so than 1979 and the rise of Thatcher. Brexit, second referendum, second independence referendum in Scotland, the future of our party system, the prospect of the most economically radical Labour government in Britain's history. All of this now hangs in the balance. So whatever you do, whatever your politics, make sure you're registered to vote. And let's see what happens. Thank you very much. Thank you.